Welcome back to Adoption Unfiltered, a podcast about examining various viewpoints of lived adoption experiences. I am one of your hosts, Sarah Easterly. I'm an adoptee, and I'm joined by Kelsey Vandervliet Ranyard, a birth parent, and Lori Holden, an adoptive parent. And together we occupy corners of adoption and invite you to join us as we cover sensitive and timely issues from our perspectives. Enjoy today's episode.
I'm so glad today to bring you my friend, Jess Tennant. Jess is almost like, well, with Jess here with us, we have all four parts of our subtitle here. We have revelations from adoptees, birth parents, adoptive parents, and Jess is one of our allies. She is not someone who adopted. She's not somebody who placed a child, and she's not an adoptee, but she is somebody who is doing some allyship in helping reimagine adoption and unfiltering adoption. So we're really grateful to have her here. Jess was a panelist with us at our New York City tour stop a couple of weeks ago. And I went, she was such a hit, and what she said is something that really needs to be heard by a big audience. So I'm gonna get right to it, Jess. First of all, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
We're so thrilled to have you. I'll introduce you a little bit more, and I'll ask you the question that we asked you before. Jess Tennant is a non-adopter and an ally and a beloved public school teacher in upstate New York, specializing in middle school special ed. Jess and I met through blogging and her site, which reflects her life shift away from pursuing parenting, is now called Finding a Different Path. In 2022, Jess was a panelist for World Childless Week, representing her viewpoint as a CNBC, which is not a network, it's a an acronym that means childless, not by choice, in that community. In the 20-teens, Jess and her husband spent several years in the adoption process, learning everything they could about various aspects of it, which, tip of the hat to them, meant inquiring beyond the predominant adoptive parent perspective. Eventually, they decided not to adopt, and what they encountered must be factored into any conversation around reimagining adoption. So Jess, here's my question to you. Did it surprise you to be asked to contribute your thoughts to an adoption book? And why do you think that your viewpoint and a conversation about pronatalism, like we have in chapter 19 featuring you and another person, why do you think that that conversation, living in a culture that values parents over non-parents, is important in unfiltering adoption?
Thanks. So I was thrilled to be included in the conversation because I feel like there's so much out there about all of the people who are successful at adoption, and there's nothing about people who have walked away from the process. We did decide to pursue adoption after years of failed infertility treatments, and it was throughout the way presented to us as the next logical step. Like, you want to be a parent, you do your infertility stuff. And then if that doesn't work out, don't worry, adoption is next. And the thought of not parenting, of leaving without becoming a mom, it made me feel ill on the inside. It felt like not a choice at the time. The agency that we worked with was endlessly positive and frequently said things like, adoption is not if, but when, and the waiting is the hardest part. And it wasn't so shocking to read in the book that it's 55, sounds horrible, available infants per, oh no, one available infant per 55 prospective adoptive parents, because our wait was not what it was said in the trainings or anything, where it was like, oh, average is 3 to 6 months. We waited and waited and waited and finally got considered and then got passed over and over again. And it was acutely evident that there it was a balance shift. So when we were waiting for longer, the agency's response to that was intensely uncomfortable because we were asked to consider private adoption through the agency, so like agency assisted private, and we did go to the training, and then we swiftly rejected it because it would make me the first contact for women in crisis, which I'm not qualified for, and I'm someone who like stands to gain from this interaction, so it seemed highly unethical to me that I would be in a way, counseling someone when there's an outcome that I would want. So we were told that the private track would increase our exposure, but not necessarily the success rate. And that just, it felt increasingly icky because the end of the training, it was like, well, once you have all of your things, your 800 number, your ad, make sure you put those things in places like laundromats and check cashing places, because that's where women in financial crisis are going to go. And that's who you want. And that felt predatory. Like, we left feeling like, oh, that's not for us. Because if the only difference is money between, you know, someone parenting their child, someone receiving the services, and then us parenting a child through adoption, that it's just felt wrong. And then after that, they were like, well, if you really want to get more calls, you'll update your grid, which is a comprehensive list of situations like race and legal situations, medical information that you say, I am able to parent, I'm not able to parent. And it's a really painful thing to fill out that grid, but it's necessary because it makes you really look at what are your supports, what are your resources, and look at what's best for the child, in addition to what you would like to do. It's not a light decision. And then to be told, well, you should open that up beyond your comfort so that you can get more calls, felt wrong, because then it's like, for the purpose of being considered, open up to situations that you already know you're not prepared for. Acquaintances would tell us to lie. They would be like, well, maybe because you're not religious, and a lot of adoption has gone through a religious lens. Take a picture of you guys in front of a church and put that in your profile book so that people will think you're religious and then they'll consider you more. And I was like, we don't want to start this with a lie, and we're not. So it just felt wrong. And it felt like everything that would get us to that point of match and placement faster were disingenuous and ethically swampy. So in that last year, before basically a stress-fueled medical situation forced us into ending our path, I had started reading increasingly wide ranges of perspectives, particularly the adoptee perspective, in part because of Lori and her blog, where she talked about the Flip the Script publications and movement. And that was super eye-opening for me, but there was such backlash among like family and friends that were like, why are you reading these scary, angry people that are telling you all the bad things? And I was like, well, they're telling me their experience with adoption as an adoptee, which I know nothing about. So as scary and uncomfortable as it might be to read something that's not that sanitized version, it was important. And it continues to be important, which is why I think Adoption Unfiltered is so important, to see all three of your perspectives, as well as allies, talking about not just your experiences, but all the 50 contributors, all the pieces that come together, especially for the adoptee, who's the only person in this constellation who has absolutely zero choice in the matter. So I'm really hopeful that this book is going to continue its path of change and open people's eyes to like all of the perspectives around adoption.
Thank you so much for all of that, Jess. I think you helped unfilter for me things that I didn't know previously with some of the things that you shared. I also want to note that your agency is probably typical in its response to your saying they, to your response of saying we're not getting picked, and they're telling you what to do. There are agencies that might do better, and there are probably some that would do even worse, depending on where they stand on the continuum of finding homes for babies versus babies for homes, which is a concept by Joyce McGuire Pavo from many decades ago. And somehow we've kind of headed more towards finding babies for homes. I do want to also say that Spence Chapin is the agency in which we held this courageous conversation, and they allowed that to happen. And they even seemed receptive to knowing about that.
Yeah, it's, I mean, even some of the things where it's like, they would say, we're here to find homes for babies and or families for babies, not babies for families, but it always felt very adoptive parent centered. And it was very much on, you're going to bring this baby into your home. And it did not at all really explicitly bring out, but that's going to be this separation, this loss of original families. And so I went back and was reading older posts from the time that all of this was happening to kind of see. And I'm like glad that there's been growth on my end too, because it's very much like all about me being a parent and how important being a parent was, and that adoption was just the next step in me being a parent, which is very cringeworthy now.
Jess, I really appreciate you. I appreciate you so much. Just everything that you're sharing and your journey and the vulnerability. I have to say, what comes up for me is just so much grief, as you know, as the adoptee. And I think it's not even you. It's just that this is how adoption is, and you named it so well. You went through your own journey trying to become parents by a lot, you know, naturally. And then, so that didn't work out. Choice two is all the fertility and infertility treatment. And the last final choice is adoption. And we know that as adoptees, we feel that we're, you know, the second choice so often, or the third choice or the last choice. And yet there's this paradox, because we're told we're so special. And we're so amazing, but that, I mean, that's a part of our story, and that is, and you know, it hurts. It's painful that that's out there. And just the commodification is so painful, that you were speaking to with, you know, and just that, that sense of, we'll get you a baby. Anyway, I appreciate the fact that you spotted predatory practices. And I think, you know, I name that grief because I think what our culture does, what adoption does, is constantly try to bypass grief. And when parents are struggling, or two people are struggling with fertility issues, and infertility, it's adoption should not be the bypass to the grief. That should not be the purpose of adoption, is to just move past that. And I feel like you speak to that so well, because I feel like you just intuitively saw that and felt that. I'm just curious, just because we so often in our adoptee spaces say adopted parents really need to grieve their infertility. They need to do their work. And so I'm curious, kind of, you know, I felt when you spoke in New York, there was a lot of sadness for you, because you wanted to become parents. And so I honor, you know, that loss, and feel that for you. And I'm just wondering what your journey was like, kind of getting to that kind of place of being able to say, I'm child free, not by choice.
Yeah, those are really great points, because I feel like every piece of this journey and all the options that are put forth are just seeped in grief. Like, someone loses in every situation, especially because we knew that my husband had fertility problems, so we never tried on our own. And we went straight into infertility treatments. And when that resulted in several losses, we actually went to donor egg. So we started thinking about genetics and what this was. And it was presented in a very, like, you know, it's the same setup, it's just different ingredients, which is another thing to look at again, because we received very little information on the egg donor and had like a single sheet of paper for who she was and what it was. And then when that didn't work out, and we explored other options and then ended up doing donor sperm, thinking, well, maybe it's that piece. The amount of information we got on the sperm donor and the willingness to meet and all of those things was such a vast contrast that it was like, why is that so different? And what would I tell my child? So we're kind of like dipping our toes a little bit into, you know, biology and biography and what constitutes family and genetics and all of that. And we actually had looked at adoption before we did the donor egg cycle, and we had gone to a smaller agency that was in our town. And they were much more honest, and in retrospect, they were much more honest and true to the actual process, because they laid out all of the things, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, and it was very scary. And we left feeling like no one will ever choose us if we choose this path, and it sounds really, really difficult, which it is. And we were like, okay, well, let's do this piece of things. But it was one of those things where the importance of becoming a mother, where the importance of becoming a parent, and I know this is awful to hear, was the first thing in my mind. Was like, I've always been told I'd make an amazing mother. I want to be a mother. When you get married, the first thing people ask you is, when are you having kids? I was married before and I wanted kids, and that didn't work out for other reasons. But like, it just seemed like, how can I do all of these things and not have a child? And because of the way that the second agency presented it, basically, we were getting to a point where we went to the second agency, which was all sunshine and rainbows. And here's a couple who waited for 3 months and they had a baby come into their lives. And it was very, very optimistic. Made it feel like, okay, so I've been in this hell for 5.5 years of being told there's no reason why I can't get pregnant, and just not getting pregnant and having an ectopic pregnancy and having a miscarriage and like all of these things and nothing working, that I was like, okay, we'll dip our toes into adoption and start researching it when it seemed like it really was going to end without anything working for me biologically or with donor material. But I felt very strongly that I didn't want to do both at the same time. And there were people that I knew who were like, kind of, this is my backup plan, as they were still trying to get pregnant. And I was like, I don't know how. For multiple reasons, I don't know how you can do that, because I feel like one of the problems is that adoption is often talked about to infertile couples as it's another way to build your family, and it's just the same. And it glosses over the complexity of adoption, the complexity of open adoption, the complexity of, you know, birth parent loss and the child's loss, and the fact that, well, if you keep telling your child the adoption story from the beginning, then they won't feel as much loss, which is not true. That they're not the same, but they're presented that way. So I'm ashamed to say that while I was reading the books about adoption, while I was thinking, okay, we're going to go to this open house and see what they say, and we left feeling very hopeful. It was like, okay, well, if this ends, we can do this, which speaks to that pain of, it was not my first choice. And the way that we framed it, which I think was to make us feel better, honestly, was, well, it's not our first choice, but it's our best choice. Like, that would make it more palatable. And I'm sure it doesn't, and I'm sorry. because it was less than a month between my final failed cycle, where I was unable to transfer, where I was in a situation where I could have had a couple different ways to go with the way that the cycle was handled, and I lost everything. And I was like, okay, I guess this is how this ends, and full steam ahead. And less than a month later, we were sitting with the home study consult at the agency, and we had filled out all our paperwork. And I didn't start filling it out before I had everything, like, so that if we did decide to do it, but it was almost like I was like, well, there, I'm shifting perspectives, and now I'm going to learn everything I have to learn about this. And, you know, and this will put my energy into something else. And I truly do not believe, to answer your question, that I resolved my grief at all before entering in, because in part I feel like I was pretending a lot, because in the end, I didn't have emotional stamina for all of the pieces that people don't really talk about with domestic infant adoption, like to have 7 months go by before anyone even saw our book, felt like, wait, that's not what you said at the orientation. And to have then your book looked at and be passed over. And sometimes they would say like, oh, you came in second. And I'd be like, how is that better? that it was emotionally difficult. And then it started feeling like, we told them like, we don't want to be considered in anything where money is the only difference, where it's literally financial distress on the part of a family or a woman in crisis is the only reason between like, we feel really strongly that there should be services or there should be something other than that. But it still felt like our life was constantly being like, kind of like, oh, your life doesn't look that great for our possible child. But then I was also one of somebody said, well, maybe your life looked so full that people were like, these people don't need a child. which was a criticism that we actually got about some of the things in there. So, I mean, I did a ton of therapy. I did a lot of self-exploration. I did a lot of writing about it. I started reading more perspectives about people who had made this shift, but it still became kind of a, this is a new pathway that I can put all my energy into. And I put so much energy into that without truly dealing with the things before that I ended up with like an autoimmune disorder. And I don't know. I know that there's countries where they make you wait a year between. And at first I was like, God, thank God I'm not in that country, but I really think it's a great idea. And I think for us, I was 38 when we entered into the process. Like just the paperwork piece. And my husband was 40. And there was this pressure of, we're just getting older and people aren't going to want to consider us because of that. And so I felt this like ticking feeling that was like the window was closing.
Jess, I really value all that. And excuse me. I can't stop thinking about what you said about the marketing, about the self-promotion. And I think a lot about this a lot, because I've worked in the field and I've seen, I also think just living in this country, we are constantly, we have advertisements in our face, right? So we've totally normalized, and self-promotion as well. Like you get on Instagram, you get on any social media platform and there's someone, self-promoting and, well, we self-promote with our book. So, you know what I mean? Like, we're not different, you know what I mean? But I think about all the ads we have in our face all day and how sometimes we see an ad that's where it feels gross, it feels predatory, but then someone will justify it. Someone will be like, well, we have to do this because of this. And I see that all the time in adoption. And with the professionals telling the families that they need to self-promote, they need to market, they need to put themselves out there. And you immediately clocked, it sounds like, that doesn't sound right. And for you, you took that opportunity to dive deeper and get the answers to the questions that you weren't receiving from the professionals who were supposed to be giving them to you. And we talk a lot about informed consent and you weren't getting any of that. I certainly wasn't getting any of that as a birth parent. But I think about the differences and how you dug deeper to go find that informed consent and you rejected the justification of go hang your flyer in a laundromat. you rejected their justification of saying, well, that's where they are. And then you said, okay, we're going to go dig for this information because we have a sense that it's out there and we're not receiving it. And I think about the women who are going into the laundromat to do their laundry for themselves, their maybe their partner or their children, and they see a flyer there, and that's their first, like you said, their first connection. They might be in crisis, and that's their first connection, is they're going to contact you, who's not a social worker, and not anybody that can realistically give them what they need or help them during a crisis. And I think about how just, yeah, that first you went to the agency to get help, you didn't get informed consent, and then the agency is educating you and kind of training you on how to be predatory and block another person in the line of fire from informed consent. So I guess my question after all of this, this big web that's in my brain right now, is how do you do that? And what do you tell parents who are also, they have something in their brain telling them this, something's not quite right here. What do you say to them? How do you help people understand how to reject a justification for bad practices, predatory practices, stuff like that?
It's very difficult because I feel like in sharing my own perspective of how I saw these things and how we moved forward and how I do want to be clear that, like, while we did step away from adoption and we did increasingly become disillusioned with the practices and limited our choices because we felt they were unethical and awful and predatory, like you said, it did take me ending up in the emergency room for us to, well, for me to leave adoption. So I still kind of bought into things a little bit, a lot of it maybe, because it's hard. And you have, you know, you always hear from people who have, you know, made it to the other side, or, you know, the narratives out there that are used in the advertisements and used in the things to attract adoptive parents, prospective adoptive parents, are always like either best case scenarios, or, you know, that it's an iceberg and there's a whole lot of really awful stuff underneath that isn't being shared. But it's hard to talk about our experience and not have some backlash, like, oh, are you saying that I'm unethical because I did adopt my baby, or I did do private, and, you know, and that's that. And there's so much, like, I have a love-hate relationship with, like, Facebook, because I feel like everyone I knew who went through the process, and I had quite a few friends who ended up adopting either through that agency, or they did the private path, or it was like a friend of a friend or something like that. And it's very much, my child is my dream come true. Dreams do come true. And it gets to me, and I feel like this opportunity to talk about it in this context has been really helpful, I think, because it's hard to go up against the, like, media machine and the voices that are like, there's nothing wrong with this on my side, or, you know, I don't want to hear that people have loss during this, because my baby's fine, my toddler's fine. And it's almost like a willful ignorance to be like, this isn't going to happen to me and my parenting situation. But we were very clear with our agency, like, when things started going, like, when they said, open your grid more, I was like, so you understand that even if I said yes to things that we had already determined we don't have the resources, or, you know, there's things that we are not comfortable with from a parenting perspective, even if we said yes to hearing those, that's just more calls that we're going to get. That's not more people, like, we're not going to say yes, put us in the mix to that. So it felt like it was almost like we were messing up their success rate is how it felt, the more that we were waiting longer and longer and not willing to change anything. So I think talking openly and honestly, I definitely have done a lot of like on the fly education of people, because I will tell you, one way to find out how people really feel is to tell them that you're not adopting anymore. That was eye-opening, because people would be like, well, why are you waiting for so long? And I'd explain, like, you know, well, we have this book and people are gonna see it, and we're not getting chosen for things. And people would be like, well, why did they get to choose? And I was like, because it's their baby, because it's not a baby farm, because it's not like this is not something where it's like some, like, I know Lori says a lot, like the blank slate, like it's not like here's this unformed child who is not experiencing this loss, and this first parent or first family who's experiencing this loss. Like, it was very much like, no, you deserve to be a mom and you deserve to get this. And I'd have to be like, no, no, that's not how it works. And I'm not better because I have money and I'm older and I'm white. Like, that's awful. And we actually waited to tell people that we weren't adopting until we'd already ended things, because people were so, they were like, well, why can't you can't stop doing this. Have you thought about it international? Have you thought about fostering? Like, it was the type of adoption that was the problem and not the whole thing as a whole. So
yes, yeah, I think,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I do think this is part of the issue here. And it's, and I wrote about this in my essay in Newsweek about informed consent. But this is part of the issue, is everyone who's giving you counsel is in your immediate circles. They're either new parents or also dealing, you know, becoming the process of becoming new parents. And yeah, I mean, I will just say adoption looked really good to my adoptive parents for many, many years. There was a rocky adolescence, but aside from that, it looked great. It looked like what a wonderful path to parenting, until I decided I finally admitted there was loss. I said out loud that, wow, this has bothered me my whole life and this has been problematic. And I started looking at all the ways it shaped me and, into some ways that were not healthy and were not serving me. And all of a sudden everybody was gobsmacked, because what? Like, it looked so good. But the parents who are struggling, or hopeful parents, you know, struggling with fertility and wanting to become, everyone advising them is an agency with a vested interest, or it's their friend circle who have a vested interest in wanting you to be a parent with them. And they're looking at their own situations and saying, it's great, don't worry. So it just takes so long for adoptees to realize, and for parents to realize that and to see that. So, and our cultural narrative, all the movies, all the everything just paints it as just this lovely, beautiful, no loss thing. So I do think that you're touching on just such a profound piece there. And it's that peer orientation. And I want to take some of the shame out of it too, because I think, you know, there is a natural human tendency to avoid grief. Like, we just don't want to feel it. It's, you know, as big griefs, and adoptees do it too. That's part of this dynamic, is that it takes us so long to start feeling the grief that in the meantime, we're faking it, or forcing our way to fake it. And then it tells everybody around us that it's great. Because we're just kids. We can't do that. That's not our responsibility, but it is still our tendency, and it reinforces this thing. And then everybody around you who's just adopted reinforcing that all you have to do is just find another way, find a different way. And then you don't have to feel the loss, and it builds up and creates problems. So anyway, I appreciate, even if it wasn't your choice, you ultimately did go there and have to feel that. And it definitely, you know, there's a loss to you. And And I just have to say, there's a real gain for us in this community because your voice is so important to help counter and to help people to think really critically all the way through. So I really appreciate your modeling.
Thanks.
I'd like to just say that I got a front row seat to watching Jess do this grief work, first on her first blog, which was mypathtomommyhood.blogspot.com. And then when she shifted, that moniker no longer fit her. So she's now at finding a different path. Is that right, Jess? Finding a different path. Yeah. blogspot.com. And almost coincidentally, I was watching you and another gentleman named Greg, both having walked away, both infertility bloggers, both having walked away from adoption, and both dealing with the aftermath of all of that. And this happened right before the leak of the Dobbs decision. And as I got really curious and I wanted to hear more from the two of you, and that's what led to me interviewing you on my podcast. And then the Dobbs decision came out and the background information of it, and that whole demand and supply of infants was made explicit by the phrase by one of the Supreme Court justices, domestic supply of infants. And that's how the idea for a chapter on pronatalism came to me, as it has to be something as we look at adoption, because we are no longer, we're explicitly acknowledging that we're not finding homes for babies, we're finding babies for homes. And this is part of why adopt-on policy is what it is to meet the demand. So if we want to, of course, we want to reduce the supply. We don't want to separate mothers and babies unless it is about the demand. And we called it out. It is about the demand. And like you said, the math that I could do based on statistics that aren't actually collected, which maybe Kelsey can speak to that too, is that it's at least 50 people waiting for every available newborn. So for me, if I put myself in your position, some of the desire to be a parent is because I wanted to be a parent. And when I put myself in your position about maybe walking away from that at some point, the other piece of that I realized was walking away from it and not becoming a parent because of what other people say and this pronatalism culture. So Jess, I wanted to know if you could tell us, in the childless, not by choice communities, what are, and I was seeing you write about all this and learning from you about pronatalism. What is that?
So pronatalism is the valuing of parents over non-parents. And I feel like as a woman, like motherhood is presented as this pinnacle of life, that if you're not a mom, you can't possibly understand the depth of the universe and like all of these pieces that make it seem like, well, if you're not a parent, you are worth less in society. You don't have, I can't tell you how many times, especially with the political landscape and everything, the phrase like childless people don't have a stake in the future, which is awful. It's like, just because I don't have kids, like I care about all the kids. Like I'm a special education teacher. I love the kids that I teach. I love my friends' kids. So you're saying I have to have kids of my own to care about the future because of my own kids? That sounds the opposite of awesome. That sounds very selfish, actually. And that definitely comes into play with the pursuit of parenthood, that, you know, no one will tell, like we never had anyone explicitly tell us that we were not going to be able to get pregnant. And I think some of that is because people react very poorly to that, because it's like, this is, even if it's true. And I ended up having a hysterectomy. It turned out I was never going to get pregnant. There was something going on that no one could find. And this idea of parenthood at all costs, I think, really plays into the adoption system and everything there, and people's reactions and people's willingness to kind of put those blinders on and be like, oh, you know, I don't want to hear the parts that aren't so great because it'll be different because it's me. And the most important thing is to be a parent. I can say with all honesty that I look forward to the day when I am too old for people to ask me, well, how come, you know, well, it's not too late. You can still have kids. And it's like, they cannot reconcile in their heads that you can be happy and have a fulfilling life and not have kids, even when you really wanted them. And that when you walk away from that, you basically are like, I'm never going to be a parent. That is never going to be my experience. That at least in our case, it had to be like, and that is that. That's the end. Because if there's ever a window of possibility, I will not survive this. The grief is too big. And so like people will be like, oh, you know what, I'm 47 now, think for a second. And people will be like, oh, it's not too late. People have babies at 50 all the time. And I have to yell, like, I don't have a uterus, like, let go of it. But I shouldn't have to do that, because it should be like, oh, you know, you have your way of fulfilling your life. And honestly, when you talk to parents, like I have friends who are parents who that is the crux of their life. And they don't want that to be the only thing that defines them. But in our society, that's what you see on TV, in the movies, in advertisements. My birthday weekend tends to often be Mother's Day weekend. And Mother's Day is, I know, a triggering holiday for many people, including pretty much, I think, everybody on the screen. Mother's Day is difficult for a variety of reasons. But it's just an onslaught. And it influences your decisions when you're looking at becoming a parent, because I was literally willing to do, well, I was initially willing to do anything to be a parent. And I really, in the medical sense, I ruined my body. Like, I have long-term impacts from the amount of IVF that I did. And then when it became about not just my body, but other people, it was easier to be like, oh, I'm not willing to do that. But you're up against this giant, heavy mass of parenthood is everything. And, you know, there's people out there who think that people with children should be able to vote for every child that they have. And if you don't have children, you can't vote. There are politicians currently who think that. And it's terrifying to me, because parenting, like the active part of parenting, is a short period of time. And then there's so many other pieces of your life. And I don't think that I am less of a special education teacher because I don't have kids of my own. And it used to drive me crazy. We would be in meetings and people who had like 2-year-olds would be like, well, as a parent, blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, your kid is 2. We're talking about a 13-year-old. Like, it doesn't make sense. And working in a school can be very difficult because everything is very child-centered and very parenting is the best thing you can do. It's your most important job. So the pressure to have a child and to be a parent, and then the guilt kind of when you're like, I don't think I can do this anymore. And I think that I can have a great life without children. It takes time to get there and work, but it is an uphill battle. And I think that was shown in the book with both things that were said to me and things that were said to Greg by well-meaning, but very hurtful comments from loved ones and random people who feel like they can comment on your life. So I think pronatalism 100% is part of the conversation, because I think that it feeds that demand. I think that it makes it so that it's easier to divorce yourself from the idea of that commodification and to be like, well, that's icky, but it's going to get me where I'm going to be able to be in this more hallowed ground or whatever.
That's so interesting and so valuable to talk about. And I'm a millennial and I've seen a huge jump in like this rejection of pronatalism among a lot of my friends who are child-free by choice, and even people younger than me who are like, it's just, I'm not interested. And but I think there's that divide of there's the child-free not by choice, where that may be a very difficult thing. And then I think there are people that I'm seeing a lot, people that are in the middle, who are not sure. I have a lot of friends that are like, I just don't know that I just don't know that I want kids. But there's that pressure, that pronatalism pressure, that is affecting how they make that decision. And it's so dangerous, because you may be just totally influenced into doing something that you really don't want for yourself. And that doesn't mean that people don't become good parents, with their living with those, choices, but it does have an effect. Like, it does have a mental, emotional effect. What advice do you have for anyone in my age group in like their late 20s, early 30s, who are dealing with the pronatalism, the air they breathe in every, because it's so porous in our society. What advice do you have for someone, either someone that wants to be a parent, that doesn't want to be a parent, but anybody that's affected by this pronatalism that's so intense and maybe clouding judgment in some form or another?
Oh, that's such a good question. I don't envy millennials and below because of the onslaught of social media and the, I've seen it as more of an adult, and I feel like there is no escape from the onslaught anymore. And that seeing kids who are growing up with social media, like they're receiving those messages from a very early age about what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. And I do think that there is change happening in the younger generations where they're much more, as you said, like there's a sense of like, I'm not interested in your boxes. I don't want to be placed in a container about who I am or what my role is or anything like that. I would say, it's an important decision because if you do become a parent, like that is a long-term commitment. And you have to know who you are and what you want out of life, but you also have to be willing to listen to those other perspectives that don't get put out there. I think with all the mommy influencers and all the things like that, I mean, Lori and I were talking to a friend who in another country who's like whose niece was saying, "Oh, I want to be a yummy mummy," because that's what the influencers were talking about. And what's happened is that when you are a parent, now you're not allowed to talk about the hard parts. You are lambasted on, is that the way you say that? On like social media or in email or whatever it may be. If you say, God, I'm really tired and it's just so hard to deal with this behavior that we're dealing with or the not sleeping or whatever. And people will be like, oh, you'll miss it when it's gone. And it's like this whole piece where everyone's got an opinion. And often it's like you're not allowed to share the other side of it, which is true of everything. Like everybody wants that Hallmark Channel kind of filter of everything. And I think one of the best things to do is to ask people for honesty and to get those perspectives of what does this actually look like for you? And what is it, have more voices that are not the predominant narrative out there to hear about the other side. Because I did not want to seek out Childless Not by Choice voices in the beginning because I was like, I don't want to be one of those people. That sounds so sad. That I, like, how could you possibly be happy with that? And then the more that I read it, the more I was like, oh, yeah, there is a sadness, but there's also a lot of really awesome pieces to an experience that I didn't know that much about because I was always told, oh, well, they don't have kids, like that kind of a thing. Or, the whole thing with social media is so awful because it's like, if you don't have kids, that's not good. If you have too many kids, that's not good. If you are a stay-at-home mom, you know, that's not good for women, but if you are a working mom, that's not good for children, and there's no winning in anything. So kind of trying to sift through and find those voices and kind of insist on elevating voices that are not the ones that are often heard. So I appreciate you.
I'm just so glad, Jess, that you raised your voice in chapter 19 along with Greg. And I would encourage everyone to listen to more of your story and what that is does look like on the back end after you have felt the grief, after you have found your support network and guides who have been on the road before you. It's really so, it has been such a privilege to watch you reclaim your life after something that was so devastating. And that you did that inner work, that you told yourself the truth, that you had the courage to look at what actually was happening for you and around you and make decisions that you could feel good about. So I'm just so grateful for you sharing it in the book, sharing it with us here today, and continuing to share your voice. We'll be putting links in the show notes to both of your blogs so people can see the before and the after if they're interested, as well as maybe I would like to put one of the communities on, or maybe a couple of community resources, because this may become an episode that gets shared with people who need to get off the adoption roller coaster or are considering getting off the adoption roller coaster. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you all who tuned in. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, rate, share wherever you listen to help others find Adoption Unfiltered. It's through healthy engagement that we make the changes needed for all those affected by adoption. And visit adoptionunfiltered.com for other episodes and more information about our other projects, including our book, Adoption Unfiltered. And visit adoptionunfiltered.com for other episodes and more information about our other projects, including our book, Adoption Unfiltered.